Welcome to East Meets West, episode 169. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
And first off, big news on the blog. We switched our comment system.
Yes, you did. When you say we, you should say I.
Yeah, I did it. We're at the suggestion of someone. We started using Disqus, D-I-S-Q-U-S. I put it into place.
Is that how you pronounce it? For some reason, I thought it was disc, like discuss, but...
Oh, discuss. Yeah, you're right. Except it's with a Q. Anyway, what this allows is a little bit of threaded discussion, so you can reply to someone's
post. And that was pretty threaded, from what I could tell. The only thing I added was the direct question to me about what I was doing in Arkansas way back when.
What were you doing in Arkansas way back when?
It was back in March. I was doing something there and had to go out there.
But you did that in the reply, so it got offset, which is kind of cool.
It's pretty cool. And I actually got myself an OpenID. I did not know about OpenID until...
You didn't know about OpenID? Right?
I knew about it, but I really didn't know anything that...
You hadn't gone looking into it?
Because I actually never came across anything that actually used OpenID.
Uh-huh.
So this is my first experience, and it's very interesting. And for those who might not know, OpenID is basically—is it a project? Is that a right way to?
It's an open source platform for allowing authentication in multiple sites with one ID. So once you've verified your credentials once, all you have to do is authorize a site to access those credentials again, and you don't have to log in with a separate login at every site.
And it works pretty well, at least with this piece of software. Works great.
Yeah, I've used it. You can use your Yahoo ID as an open ID. I believe Google's part of the alliance as well.
The alliance.
I wanted to try something that wasn't already pre-made. I don't know. So I have another thing to remember.
Well, the thing about the open ID is that it will make it so that you don't have to remember anything if enough people start using it, so that you can just have your open ID and that's your only login,
which is cool
for all sites. Of course, you have to get all sites using it
up on the
for that to work. But
so I wonder if I can use my open ID now and create a new Google or Yahoo account.
Theoretically, yes. I'm not sure if it works both ways
because I chose a name, login name, that I know has already been used on one of those other sites. So I'm wondering if there's going to be some sort of conflict.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing because I know the way Yahoo works, you can use your Yahoo ID as your open ID, but you can't use an open ID created outside of Yahoo to log into Yahoo. I'm not sure how Google works. I'm guessing it's probably the same way. Until they all interoperate, though, it's not going to...
It's kind of a moot.
Yeah.
So I guess Congress extended another $2 billion into the Cash for Clunkers.
Who the frack cares? Why is Cash for Clunkers getting such press? Who cares?
I think
this is the lowest priority, little bitty, tiny thing that is just like taking the whole debate away from Iran, North Korea, healthcare. What do we freaking care about Cash for Clunkers?
I think partially because of the amount of money that's being...
it's not even that big as a percentage, honestly.
No, it's not. For the amount of money the current administration is planning to spend, it is quite small. But it's significant in that it's supposed to help. I think people are seeing this as kind of the watershed moment when you see an increase kind of a bump up in economic indicators, or at least that's what they're hoping. That this will not only directly spur... I know you're very bored. Only reason I bring it up is because my dad took advantage of it and got a car.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's cool. Good for him. It's like, there's plenty of government programs where you can get rebates. There's like that guy that wears the suit full of question marks that, sells the book on late night TV for $20. You know, get free government money. This is just one of those programs that's in his book.
Wow, you mean really? he had this very exact plan in that book?
Yeah, well, that's all his book is a list of all these plans. And that's one of them that's in the book, I'm guessing. I've never read the book, I shouldn't say. But it's that kind of stuff, It's like, here are all the free government grants and programs. There's billions of them.
Billions, you say?
I'm sure.
And there's if there was $100,
there's one for every star.
$10 to $100 each, say $10 on each program. That's $10 billion just waiting.
There's also the Taliban in disarray now, fighting each other in
Pakistan because supposedly a key leader was taken out through the use of a missile attack striking.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's one of those things where you can only measure the fallout maybe within a couple of months after, because after these types of things, usually there's always kind of a lot of, you know, chickens running around with their heads cut off because they're trying to assess the situation. Once everything kind of dies down and that group is able to kind of get a measure of what's happening, then you can figure out how significant or damaging it it was.
You know, one of the problems we're dealing with news-wise is it's August, mm-hmm. and most of the Western world, even the U.S. to a large extent, takes August off. The U.S. doesn't have the entrenched, like, companies closed down during mm-hmm. August, but a lot of people taking their summer vacations in the U.S. And in Europe, places just close up shop mm-hmm. for August. You know, the front page of The Economist this week, America's unjust sex laws.
It's funny because...
Which is a good story, yeah. But cover story? I mean, if you look at all the other cover stories this year, it's kind of a...
My thing with that cover story is that they published this very similar story not too long ago, four months ago.
Yeah.
Like, not as a, you know, front page thing. But
no, it was just an article.
Yeah, so yeah. I'm wondering if they're just, you know, they're kind of re-digging out some of the older stories.
Yeah, because I just don't think they have much else to talk about. They're tired of healthcare. They've been beating that to death. They're tired of the economy, because I think every cover this year has been about the economy. And the other stories they had to choose from, German economy, you know, is out of whack. Justly proud of its exporters, but it also needs to worry about markets closer to home. Britain's energy crisis. Ooh, boy, that's barn burner. Regulating executive compensation. Well, that's also been done before. Generic drugs. And this, I would have done this one. Islam and heresy, where freedom is still at stake. I listened to an interesting interview with a imam from East London talking about, you know, the idea of apostasy and how it's a medieval Islamic
tradition
to put out a death penalty for apostates. But in fact, in Quran, at least this guy's interpretation of in the Quran, it says you have to tolerate all viewpoints in order to win people over to Islam. And in other words, you don't go and you kill the apostates.
Was that part of the Economist podcast?
Yeah, it was.
That's one of the few features that they've integrated into their site I really like. They also do kind of that poll thing, have you seen? Where, you know, there's two people who are on the debate of an opposite side of an issue, and then readers go in and then they vote based on their replies and responses each side gives to it. I thought that was kind of cool, but... You know, some of the more recent ones have kind of been less interesting than the first one they started out with. I'm wondering if The Economist is trying to make a full bore move into being an exclusively online content. Because one of the things is, like, you know, print's dying, you know, publishing's expensive, you don't get enough readers.
From what I can tell, The Economist is doing it right, where they're continuing to publish a very good print publication. They're doing their best to make sure it's profitable. Which shows in the quality of the paper, you know, going. I don't mean the quality of the paper as in the content quality, but I mean, like, you know, the actual paper it's printed on. It's been getting thinner and thinner over the years, and, you know, still taking in advertisements, turning over the bucks, but at the same time providing a really compelling online presence, so that as that magazine starts to feel a little thinner and a little thinner, you mm-hmm. still want to continue to subscribe because you're getting it fleshed out online. Some of that stuff is available for free, like the podcast, whether you subscribe or not, but it's still, you know, mm-hmm. it's still part of that whole experience. And it makes a difference if you actually have the magazine when you listen to those podcasts that you can go back and refer to mm-hmm. And kind of flesh out the podcast than if you're just getting the podcast. I think they're doing it right. They're saying, you know, we're going to put out some valid content and push people to the things that we do sell. It actually reminds me, Mark Cuban had a really interesting post up on his blog today about why it is right for News Corp to start charging for content, but here's how they should do it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said two basic things. I disagree with one, but I totally agree with the other. The thing I agree with is he said, start coming up with packages, you know,
like
come up with
packages?
Like the News Junkie package, and you give access to, you know, a bunch of content worldwide, all your different
portal,
all your different publishers. It's more like an insider package. And then you also get a certain number of free downloadable movies, like maybe documentary stuff mm-hmm. from your movie arm. You get some You get some merchandise from your merchandising arm, maybe a couple free books from your publisher. Use the fact that you've got this incredibly huge empire of publishing and get people to pay $10 a month to be a news junkie member, and then do it with sports and do it with music and leverage all that stuff. And I'm like, that's a fantastic idea, because you don't just put up a paywall. You leave a lot of stuff free on the web for the people passing by to keep becoming familiar. And you make money off the super fans who are willing to come in and like pay for the extra stuff. I think that's a great idea. The other part of his idea that I didn't find so hot, and I don't think is even necessary, is he says block the aggregators. Cut off the Drudge Reports and the small sites that just take all of your links and put them on their own site so that people don't have to come to your part. He's like, make people go to the New York Post. Make people go to the Sunday Times. Don't let the aggregators steal your content. I don't think you have to do that.
Yeah,
I don't think there's that big of an effect. Because of all of he said about the superfans aren't going to go to the Drudge Report.
Well, having used aggregators, I invariably end up going to the original source site anyway, because most aggregators list a specific story, and there might be associated stories, but they don't list them. And second of all, which I really enjoy, I don't know if you enjoy this, is I like reading the comments that people have to a particular story. And that's, a lot of posters tend to be like repeat posters, but you can always get a good sense of what a story is and how it relates contextually to, say, a group of people. Say, like, if it's a Canadian story, then you can get a Canadian's perspective by the replies and stuff. I think that's really kind of cool, and you don't normally get that through an aggregator. You just get the story.
And I think you could even monetize that. To a certain extent, you could have a couple levels of discussion there where it's like open comments or, like a super fans comment area.
Super fans.
Where you kind of get rid of the riffraff, so to speak. And some of the trolls and spammers and stuff, they can't get in. And you've got a more selective amount of commentary. I think that could be part of that package. It's basically you're paying for a filter. You can see all the comments for free. Or you can, or if you're part of this $5 a month super fan, it gets filtered down to the other super fans. Yeah, it's just throwing out ideas there, but I think he's got the right direction, which is don't just go charge for your content. Don't put a big paywall up that says, if you want to watch Fox News online, you have to pay $5 a month, because you're shooting yourself in the foot.
But what you do is you put the highlight reel of news. You make it for free. Now, if you want specific, ones that people who are interested would dig down, they would probably pay for, the nominal subscription fee that it would cost anyway.
Yeah, and you got to make it easy. You got to make it really easy for people to see the value and pay for it. Because right now, what happens is we're used to paying $3 a week for a newspaper, but we are not used to paying $3 a week for a website, and we won't. People just won't do that.
I think one thing I've noticed which really annoys me about buying stuff online is, and it caught me thinking because I used OpenID, is like, I know PayPal is designed for you to be that one account that you use to pay for a lot of things, but it'd be just so much easier if you logged in and it wasn't, you had a choice besides PayPal, besides punching in your credit card number. It's an online account, so you could always keep track and tabulate all your purchases.
Well, that's PayPal. I mean, what's the difference between what you're describing?
No, outside of that, that's...
You mean you want more than one PayPal?
Competitor. So more than just PayPal, because I've had bad experiences with PayPal.
Gotcha. In other words, you wish there was like three or four PayPals.
Yes.
Gotcha.
PayPal-like sites, because I think it would actually help monetize a lot of these things, because right now it's still kind of kludgy.
Well, there's been a lot of rumors that Apple would do that. Amazon actually has the makings of that. They just don't let anyone other than Amazon use it.
Amazon's act was quite brilliant in incorporating a lot of the smaller stores into its larger online store, because I go to Amazon for that reason. It's like, I have that one Amazon account, and now I can buy, shampoo, soap, books, whatever. And I only have to use one account, and I know Amazon will handle any kind of fulfillment issues that I might have. So I don't have to worry about that. And I think it's, if you could kind of take that model and and encompass a lot more diverse products would be awesome.
Well, so many people have tried too, and it just hasn't worked. There's a Google payment system. There's a Yahoo wallet. There's the Microsoft wallet, and none of them have.
I don't think any of them have
been able to compete with PayPal.
I think you need a real solid financial, you know, booms, you know, supported by.
But that's the weird thing about PayPal is it was a .com startup. I mean, it was right in there at the same time as Flooz and Webvan and
I think eBay helped really kind of propel.
But
it.
eBay didn't buy it till later. Like they really were on their feet still after the bust, and then eBay came in and said, "Hey, you know, we'll buy you." Now maybe they were about to crumple at that point, but they were impressive in their ability to succeed. Probably because they actually had a business plan, which was to make money off people transacting money,
yes.
Which that was the only thing that actually did happen on the internet back in the day. Got a. Shall we talk about some of these comments here? SoCal Jess, thought you guys might enjoy this. Choose your own apocalypse at Slate.com. My favorite apocalypses include neocolonialism, space harvesting, Texas secession, and oldocracy. I guess that's
What's considered neocolonialism? Is that when like companies like start forming colonies or buying enough swath of land that they become the de facto government?
Could also be people from outer space coming and colonizing us.
That's cool, I guess. Depends.
You could interpret it that way. Let's see. You want to pick one here?
What's the one that has the red wedge at the top?
This right here? That is push-button warfare.
We already have that.
Yeah. Anthrax.
Oh, are you supposed to select a bunch of them? What's the one with the Swiss flag on it? Oh, information war.
Let's see. Let's push-button warfare. Nanoscale production allows anyone to make tanks and flying drones with the press of a button. With sophisticated weaponry available to all the nation-states, cease to be an important entity. And we all kill each other. Media piracy. The American film and music industries go bankrupt as piracy becomes universal. The United States ceases to be the world's leading exporter of culture, and the country declines in influence as images of America no longer proliferate worldwide.
Actually, wouldn't piracy cause it to proliferate?
Proliferate?
Spread.
Yeah, I couldn't say it either. I'm trying to find these ones that she... Oh, La República del Norte is a good one, actually.
That one?
Professor Charles Trujillo argues that a growing Latino population in the Southwest will eventually reclaim the territory that Mexico lost to the United States in the 1800s. I actually had that as part of Boiling Point as well.
There's a couple of flaws with his argument, though. That's assuming that all Latinos are Mexican, which they aren't. And that they all
does it need to assume that?
Yeah, but if he says lost by Mexico, he's
no, he's just saying that territory in the Southwest will be reclaimed by Latinos. It was lost by Mexico. It's not necessarily. It may be led by a Mexican resurgence, but they're not going to give it back to Mexico. They're just going to, in his theory, they're going to secede and form their own nation.
No, a Hispanic nation.
See,
that's the thing. That's my biggest issue with that. Not all Hispanics are the same. It's like saying that if you have an area populated by Asians, something's going to break away into its own Asian republic.
Yeah, but even so, while you're right, there is a shared feeling of experience there that could be used to bond them together. It's the Latino movement, and it's a very real thing. Latino movement includes all Hispanics.
No, I understand that, but I've talked to a couple of people back in college who were both Central American, and they say, the issue with a lot of the La Raza movements is they're heavily Mexican oriented, and it doesn't really speak to them about their particular.
Yeah, but maybe they've changed that.
Maybe, I don't know, but I mean, it's easy for someone to say, but it's the same things like all white people suddenly think.
No, it's not. It's not the same. It's not the same at all.
So?
No,
why
I
not?
Don't, because I covered the Latino movement pretty closely at the University of Illinois, and you're right. It's very Mexican dominated, but it is very much also trying to speak to all Spanish speaking peoples and the experience they share, especially if they're from Central America and Mexico. Not so much if they're from Europe, but it's trying to say, look, you know, we share a bond, we share a common language, we share a common experience in the United States, and let's band together and use our strength to advance our cause.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I understand that, but I mean,
it's not like all white people saying, we're a bunch of white people.
I understand it, but that's my issue is that there are many things that are similar, but there are also many things that are not similar between those countries. There are very real differences between an El Salvadorian and a Guatemalan and a Honduran.
I mean, I'm not denying that.
And I don't know. I mean, perhaps, you know, there might be a movement where they can all push aside certain differences as in some ways that the American Asian movement tried to get off. But I still think it's too fractured for them to kind of have a single consensus movement. I can see it having influence on the state community level where you say, you know, our needs are our particular issues in regards to the community, jobs, schools, education, stuff like that. But to kind of think that there's this massive kind of single-minded pursuit, I don't think that exists.
Nobody's saying it has to be a single-minded pursuit, though. But if it carries enough capital, I mean, it's like saying there can't be a Spanish language channel because it's, you know, going to be heavily dominated by Mexicans. No. There is. There's Univision, and it caters to all kinds of Spanish-speaking people. For the same reason, there could be a party developed. That's all he's saying. Yeah. It doesn't have to mean like, oh, it'll happen by saying we are all the same. I'm saying is, while everything you're saying is true, I can see a way where this could coalesce the same way that you can have a party start around green, or you can have a party start around Christianity, or you can have a party start around fiscal responsibility. No, you can have a party start around
I accept that. I think in the long term, though, I mean, it's one of those things where you try to group a people based on what you assume is a similar background and heritage, and it's not. I mean, I don't, you know, I look at things like the Asian American and, you know, kind of a political movement to happen, and they've had some success. At the same time, you know, they haven't, because, you know, Asians comprise a very large multitude of different people, different backgrounds, different experiences. They also have shared experiences. For example, colonialism was really big in Southeast Asia. Doesn't mean that they all, you know, have the same ideas. I actually think that in the long term, people will have more of a political leaning based on local needs, local desires. So everyone in the Bay Area will coalesce and kind of have a Bay Area-centric kind of political thought. People in Southern California will have kind of a very Southern California political thought.
None of what you're saying really, I think, undermines the thought that there could be a Norte Mexicano state movement out of that. And the reason being, and I think the Asian is a good example of the difference here, there isn't an Asian out there, right? Mm-hmm. And I know what you're saying, which is there really isn't a Hispanic out there either. But there is a lot more similarities between the Central American and Mexican groups than there is between Asians, because they are all pretty much from the same region, and they are all speak the same language, and they have, while they have different traditions, they're all fairly Roman Catholic, and they have a lot of similar traditions. All I'm saying is a lot more so than Asian, where you could be from Vietnam, mm-hmm. or you could be from Mongolia, mm-hmm. and you're totally different. You don't speak the same language. No, you've got very different. So I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying, but I also think that there's enough there that a movement could be put around. That's all.
And I'm not saying that it's not entirely impossible. I'm just, having, you know, spoken to a lot of Hispanic Latinos who are both Mexican, Central American, South American. They have issues with each other as well as and you know, it's one of those things. And my thing is,
I know what you're saying, which is it's just not one big happy party like hey, we're all Hispanics. Well, I mean, that's true of African Americans even, which is even a more cohesive unit than Hispanic, right? But there's a lot of differences between how different African Americans see the world. There's Republicans, mm-hmm. there's Democrats. I mean, you know, but that doesn't mean there haven't been very successful movements for that. So that's kind of the analog there.
Yeah, but in the end, I still think it's somewhat a little overly ambitious in that scope.
I think it's wise for you to say, like, don't just lump all Hispanics together. Yeah. They're not all the same.
I just don't think that
people do that, that means it can't happen, that there can't be a movement arise out of that.
No, I'm not saying that there will be no movement, but to say that to the extent that he's suggesting, I don't know.
If you look at the cultural region, and this goes to your point of what you're saying about politics being more localized, there is a lot of similarity between the issues in the Central Valley of California and northern New Mexico. There are a lot more similarities between those two areas than between the Central Valley in California and northern California. And when I'm thinking, yeah. I'm thinking up there, Humboldt County,
Eureka,
and Oregon. Those are similar. Washington, Oregon, northern part of California. Those are more similar than the other region. Mm-hmm. And so if you looked at the little map that was on the icon there, he's basically saying southern part of California, big chunk of Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, mm-hmm. those are all, you know, those are all a chunk that used to be part of Mexico, and they rise up again. And I think there is a cultural heritage there that's very strong. I'm not saying it's going to happen either, but I think it's certainly not. You shouldn't dismiss it as an idea.
I'm not dismissing it. I think you pointed out, I just don't like when people make a very broad, sweet generalization of a large group of people. Because I think
how like an Asian?
Yes. So I don't know. It's one of those peculiarities that really annoy me when people do that. So that's probably my primary issue with it. It's just that, like, oh, suddenly you're all Spanish speaking. Thunk.
And if you take that region, get even further fueling your argument, the region as a whole is predominantly of Mexican descent, and so you wouldn't even have to have, you know, if you take out the Angelenos, like take Los Angeles out of it, it is very majority of Mexican descent, because a lot of them are not. This is what a lot of people in the Midwest, I found to my utter amusement when I moved to Texas, didn't understand, is a lot of the Mexicans in the Southwest of the United States didn't grow up in Mexico, weren't born in Mexico. They're descended from people who lived in that region when it was part of Mexico, and they never moved. The United States came in and took over the area.
Well, you know, I mean, there are a lot of Mexicans that were part of the secessionist movement in Texas during its separation from Mexico. I mean, that's why they gave them they named themselves Tejanos.
Yeah.
So, you know, and ultimately, you know, Mexico is a political construct, from colonial Spain. So whether or not that holds true, you know, because one of the things I've noticed is that there's been a greater tendency to kind of separate the Spanish from the indigenous in Latino cultures, because, you know, some people might be surprised, but a lot of the Indians that come up from Mexico, from Central America, don't speak Spanish or read Spanish as well as you would think, because, oh, look,
it's
a second language. That's not their primary language. And it's one of those things when people make broad sweeping generalizations like that, it's like, well, that's not going to help them. You want to target programs that help those particular people, not just because, oh, you're from south of the border, we're just going to do this A, B, and C.
Yeah. Good points. Well, I know some people like Matt are not excited about the discussion, the new format, but we'll try it out for a little while, see how it works. Give it a whirl. There's some great discussions on the last week's episode about the healthcare plan. About SoCal Jess's posting that we've been kicking around here, and some discussions about different widgets that we could use. But let's try this one for a couple weeks. I know Matt was upset because he couldn't get his username, which that's kind of weird. But let me see if there's a setting or something that I can use to let you use your actual subbrilliant.com username for the same thing. All right, folks, thanks for listening.
All right, bye.